Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to 2021. This will be our first chinwag of the new year. And as Charlie just reminded me, it'll be about 2 years since we started. So a kind of anniversary of sorts. I don't know the exact date. I don't know if you remember the date, Charlie, but it was definitely February.
Yeah, I think we pushed it out on, well, first of all, good morning, everybody. Happy New Year, belatedly. Apologies for a slight late start to the Chinwag series. We hope you'll forgive us. But it is, as John just said, 2 years. I think 16th of February 2019 was our first foray into the world of podcasts. I've been, I think, looking, I think we've clocked up 40 podcasts in those two years, John, and obviously listeners are growing exponentially as well, which is nice to hear. So thank you very much, all listeners. If you've got any future ideas that you'd like us to discuss, we'd be all ears, as they say, and perhaps we can open the microphone up as well. But John, back to you.
So in true lockdown fashion, I'm not in my normal room today, so apologies for any dog barking in advance that may occur. Today we thought, it was one of your ideas, Charlie, we thought we'd talk about, I think, as you'd call it, hard to decarbonise segments. Have I got that correct? Do you want to expand on kind of what you had in mind?
Yeah, well, well, my initial tactic, John, was to throw it back to you. And if you were to say, if there were to be any hard to reach parts of the economy, where might we be looking? We've had a big push towards electrification, I suppose. The grid is going green. And now if we are to get to net zero, we've got to build on that and start to winkle out the hard-to-reach areas of the economy. So if I was to throw it back to you in the first instance before I share some of my thoughts on where they might be, where would you see the hard-to-reach? Perhaps the top of my list perhaps might be heat. I would think that's it's one that, yes, there have been a couple of false dawns on it, but it does strike me as a big sector. And if you're going to have to get at it, how would you do it?
Yeah, I think there's... I don't think there's any major surprises there. I mean, if we look at where decarbonisation has been happening, electricity is where we've made quite a lot of progress. Still lots to do, but furthest down the line by a mile. Heat and transport have both been slow. Transport, arguably, I would say there's potentially a relatively quick change coming in that, certainly in kind of more developed markets. Or markets where, with reasonable grid infrastructure, I think electrification is going to happen reasonably quickly. Heat is proving to be much slower. And then the other one that kind of falls outside the energy sphere. But if you look at kind of carbon's emissions pie charts and so on, scary things like steel and cement and some of the chemical stuff actually have really quite enormous carbon footprints. I mean, cement and steel, both bigger than the aviation industry, that kind of stuff. Well, we tend to focus a lot on kind of jumbo jets and so on, but don't necessarily think about sort of concrete, cement, steel, those kind of things. So yeah, I would say heat is probably a big one, and then some of the kind of industrial chemistry type applications, I would say, are other big chunks as well.
Thanks for that. I'd probably add a few to that. I suppose heating is obviously we're in the UK, so that springs to mind, but other parts of the globe might have a cooling requirement as well. I would think for the niches. I know that some of the companies I've worked for thought that agriculture was going to be largely decarbonised by now. That seems to have not happened. I'd be perhaps looking at the government itself. I'd be looking at things that have been excluded, NHS. I'd be looking at sport. I'd be looking at, I know the Olympics have been discussing that, but there was a report last week on the Premier League table of sustainability. Sadly, my team, Burnley, was a bit bizarre because it's surrounded by wind farms, the turf moor, but it doesn't seem to have extended itself into the stadium sustainability. So there's a bit on sport, but there might be other sectors as well. And I think you've mentioned some of the big emitters, but I think rather curiously that some of this has been discussed before. I think when the NFO, non-fossil fuel obligations, were discussed, and some of these big hitters on the energy usage front have more or less been excluded to date. So and that leaves a bit of a room for I suppose a catch-up. So there's a bit of a reality check now. I think in certain cities that are ahead of the 2050 net zero agenda, somewhere at 2038 in Manchester, 2030 in Glasgow, and that's not far off in major project terms. And if you're a sector that's been, if you might be the government itself or the universities or perhaps of who knows what offices and things, and then suddenly somebody says, well, shows you route map to net zero within 9 years, it might be a cause for a bit of panic for some of these hard to reach sectors.
Yeah, well, I think you need to separate sectors from applications, because obviously those sectors, we're still talking about heat and the other kind of applications we talked about generally. I mean, cooling, the thing with cooling is that's going to be electrification. I mean, it's air conditioning. It's going to be, it's adding huge demand, and then it's going to be meeting that demand through more electrification, more renewable electricity, basically. I think with heat and cooling as well, the other thing that hasn't got enough of a mention, but I know is now being given a lot more focus at kind of high levels, not only government, but organisations like the International Energy Agency as well, as efficiency. Because obviously the easiest way to decarbonise heating and cooling is just to need less of it, which is to insulate spaces much more effectively. So I think that will be a big, big part. I mean, I notice talking about things like public sector taking a lead. Was it just this week? I think was the Biden administration talking about all federal vehicles going to be electric vehicles. I don't know what the timescale was. So again, I think you're starting to see some initiatives around that. But yeah, certain sectors definitely, depending on what their usage is, have different impacts. And certainly public sector, if you're going to, as a policymaker, be driving this stuff, I mean, it's kind of an obvious thing to say that the things that you can control, the sectors that you can control in the UK, the health service, for example, it's kind of a no-brainer really to make those go towards low carbon. And then also other things they can control are regulations around new housing, for example. I mean, some of the housing that goes up here is kind of nonsensical, really, in this day and age. Some of the new housing, in a few years' time, they're all going to have to retrofit at huge expense to take out, either add more insulation or take out old boilers and replace them with with newer ones and so on. So, I mean, that we should be thinking ahead on those kind of things as well.
Yeah, a lot in there. Let's hope that the housing developers are aligned with the net zero agenda. I'm not 100% convinced that from some of the mood music that might be the case. But a lot in what you said. First of all, on the energy efficiency side, which seems to have been around a long time. I used to remember TV adverts saying, don't use your phone. I remember one, bizarrely, when I was in Albania, on television saying, don't use electricity, which the strange things happened over there. So it was like, would a company advertise not to use its product? So it's difficult to see some of the incumbents, if you like, wanted to do that with too much enthusiasm. Hey folks, don't use our products, might not encourage investment, although from a wider picture, it's been around a long time. Didn't we have the Green Deal? What happened to that? And the 2008 and all the CERT and all this kind of stuff. So certainly stuff seems like a bit deja vu. There were going to be big kind of training people for home insulation and all this kind of, it was part of a CERT thing, and I think David Cameron to dispatch that into the litter bin. I suppose it will be like any, if we are to reach the hard to reach sectors, it's going to be a bit of stick and a bit of carrot. So I suppose if you were stick, how would you discourage some of, I suppose you'd be not looking for a very favourable trajectory for diesel or any fossil investment. So if you want to drive into Manchester with your old clapped out jalopy like I've got, you might encompass a fine every day, but that you might be exempt. And obviously they've already got that in London. I can see much more of that. So as a kind of policy encouragement and a stick and a carrot for the hard to reach sectors, obviously you've mentioned transport right at the top. I suppose to most people, that's cars and vans and trucks, perhaps trains on the back of that as well.
I mean the stick side is, as you say, it's already some cities have taken the lead on that in terms of emission zones and so on. I mean, the obvious one that keeps perennially floating around is carbon price. The challenge, of course, there is actually getting, you can agree one within a territory, but then you get into issues around carbon leakage and firms are shifting to other territories where the carbon burden isn't quite so high. So, but that, I mean, that's the kind of obvious way to penalise emitters and benefit non-emitters. Back to things like efficiency. I mean, the problem with efficiency has always been kind of how do you monetize it? Industry tends to like building things. Industry likes building things. Finance people like financing things. They like infrastructure. They like new stuff. As you say, efficiency is almost kind of reversing that and saying, okay, well, let's put into place measures that avoid us building new stuff or needing new stuff. We can generate less. We can generate less heat, generate less electricity and whatever. So yeah, it's from a lobbying point of view, as you say, it's always been a hard sell. It's a good question. How do you encourage companies who have kind of been built from the ground up to sell more stuff to actually encourage people to use less? Do they compensate that simply by raising the prices on the stuff they do sell? I don't think it's an easy thing to do, which is why it's fundamentally got to be a policy-led initiative with support, I guess, socially as well.
Yeah, the social element, I think, is often forgotten here. And I think David Cameron hit some. It was Ed Miliband, wasn't it, who hit something of a political bullseye with his. He made energy something of an election issue, electricity, and he said, "Look, we're going to cap." These bills because they're out of control, which went down like a lead balloon in the energy utility. I was working for at the time, but he did bring it to public attention, and then bizarrely the opposition then started to take heed of some of that. Some of this seems to have been in and out for a long time. As I say, I can remember energy efficiency campaigns got most of my life, and yet here we are, this great body. I said, well, that's top of the agenda. Well, hold on, what have you been doing for the last 40 years? Or have they been doing? So perhaps I do them a disservice.
I mean, I guess the obvious driver for energy efficiency, of course, is the consumer spending less money. And ultimately, I guess that's what's going to, particularly on things like heating, that's what's really going to ultimately determine a lot of the choices that consumers make. Is the price they pay, how much they pay for gas, versus how much they would have to pay for the alternatives. A bit of that might be upfront costs because they've got to shift around the infrastructure in their house, and then on an ongoing basis, it would be operating costs. How much does electricity compare to gas? How much does gas compare to decarbonised forms of gas? Be that biomethane, hydrogen, whatever else you want to dream up. And I think that, I mean, those arguments are starting to come out, I think, a bit more. In the industry, we tend to focus a lot on kind of wholesale prices, both for gas and electricity and so on, and you get all these excitement about negative prices and that kind of stuff. For most consumers, what they've seen for the last 20 years is just their prices of energy inexorably heading upwards. So I think that's a good sell. It's certainly working in the transport side, I would say. When people looking at, initially, there's obviously a bigger upfront cost for EVs at the moment, but people that have got them obviously can point out lower running costs, lower maintenance costs, that kind of stuff. So, ultimately, it's going to be people's wallets at the consumer side will drive it, and to some extent, industry will have to follow.
Yeah, just picking up on that, you would have thought that the market might actually offer the solution. But again, I remember some of the companies I've worked for, they introduced various forms of smart meter over the time. And one of them, you used to plug your kettle in and you'd see this thing whizzing around, and you think you'd never make a cup of coffee again after seeing that thing go into overdrive. And then, of course, you take it out and forget about it, and life carries on as per normal. Certainly the smart meter that we seem to have had installed doesn't seem particularly smart to me.
Meters, that strikes me as one of those where they've been, from an industry, well, from a policy side particularly, and to some extent from an industry side, you can see why they want them installed, but they've never really made any obvious benefit available to a consumer as to why you might want it installed. It's just been something that they kind of want to encourage you to have because it's kind of good for the system. There are a few companies on the electricity side. There are some of the smaller retailers, some of which are getting bigger because they keep buying some of the bigger ones, offering kind of smart tariffs where you, for example, can benefit from negative prices. There's retail tariffs that track wholesale tariffs and that kind of stuff. And so there are some examples now where actually, and you can't do that without a smart meter, where having a smart meter opens up access to tariffs, which you could certainly benefit from. But in the main, smart meters has been a kind of prime example of how not to roll out a new technology, really. It's been very much kind of policy push. There's been no real explanation to consumers as to, will it make them better off? What does it do that's going to improve, other than just kind of show them a bit about what they use, which isn't necessarily, as you say, other than the bit of interest, doesn't necessarily shift. They've still got to make a cup of coffee. They've still got to cook their dinner or whatever. But there certainly doesn't seem to be much kind of rational or sensible kind of marketing or explanation of by having this, how would you personally be better off? It's no good saying that the system sometime in the future will be notionally better off. You've got to kind of you've got to hit people in the pocket, really, and say, look, this is what you can do that you couldn't do before.
Yeah, I'd like to think there was an upside to that. I don't know whether you get some rebate or something, but just thinking of another strand that you highlighted right at the start of the discussion, and that was around transport. And when I'm watching the adverts on television from the endless Premiership matches that I'm watching at the moment, so those that are telling us not to leave the house are interspersed with almost every other one seems to be a wind turbine connected to some form of EV. How do you see the transport sector? I mean, EVs are obviously, I looked at the figures in places like Norway, and I think they're outselling traditional engines. And so how, I mean, we're talking about the energy and the hard to reach places, and that would have been a nightmare, wouldn't it? How to decarbonize transport. But if the TV adverts I watch are anything to go by, the EVs are almost a case of take your pick. Which one works best for you? Is it going to be some kind of hybrid or some kind of new super duper thing or something that seems to plug into a turbine directly with a sunroof on the top of it? What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, EVs is ultimately, from a consumer point of view, it's going to be about the product again. What we're going to see over the next couple of years particularly is a lot more choice. We're going to see a lot cheaper models. I'm not sure what the current... Well, I mean, again, we've got to be slightly careful as people make the comparisons, almost, if you like, at a wholesale level about when an EV will be cost parity with a conventional car of the same size. That doesn't mean that they're going to sell them for the same price, because manufacturers will obviously sell them at the price they can get away with. And you'd have to say at the moment, the kind of EV market is probably more driven by people that are prepared to pay a bit of a premium. So manufacturers will obviously gobble that premium up. And also they've got to recoup some of their R&D costs and remanufacturing costs and all that kind of stuff. But I think ultimately, that market is going to be, as soon as when EVs become similar cost to buy, and at the same time they're cheaper to run, you can charge them at home, you don't have to bother about what the fuel prices are and all this kind of stuff, that switchover could happen very quickly, at least on a new car basis. Obviously, for all the cars on your road, you've then got to work through the second hand. I think 80% of car purchases in the UK are second hand, so it's still a while until the whole fleet passes over.
If you were head of transport for Glasgow City Council and said, look, I've got 300 vehicles to buy in the next 3 years or something, and then you'd you see this clock ticking, you'd signed up to this new roadmap to get to net zero by 2030, it might just inform your decision making, certainly on a fleet basis, and certainly from the public sector and the all the people that I outlined before that perhaps have been a little bit inoculated from there. And think about the police, who knows where EVs will creep into once they prove they're not.
Yeah, I think fleets might change over much more quickly than private vehicles, because fleets are much less kind of emotional purchases and much more kind of, here's a spreadsheet, here's how much it costs over a certain number of years with depreciation and tax and fuel costs and operating costs and all that kind of stuff. So and as soon as that, what they call total ownership cost, is cheaper with EVs, which arguably, depending who you listen to and what numbers you look at, it is in some cases already, and depending how you use them and so on, then that change over fleet managers, when it comes to renewing the fleet, they'll shift the whole fleet over. So that could happen very quickly. Whereas I think with consumers are going to be driven as much by what their next door neighbour says as what
they're... Well, I'm in that bracket myself. I see a couple of Teslas. So. They've reached even my part of the country now, and they usually people swivel their eyes a little bit. Okay, so there's some good traction there. Of course, there's fewer moving parts in these EVs, so you'd thought that the O&M costs might be quite advantageous. But coming back to another strand that you... you flagged right at the start as well, and that was steel. I did connect into some grand, it was some government-led export kind of seminar the other day, and they certainly flagged steel right at the very top. Obviously, I think there are a couple of sore points in the UK steel industry at the moment. I'm not quite sure what the scenario is around Scunthorpe. I think the government is looking for some kind of bailout. But if you were to think, I mean, I'm aware of a couple of steel and hydrogen initiatives in the Baltic states, and if steel is to go on to get to a green route, how would you go about it?
Yes, steel's an interesting one because it kind of ties in with those other sectors we've talked about anyway. So, in Sweden, for example, there's the main decarbonisation at the moment is that's been most prevalent is things like replacing coke with hydrogen, for example, to decarbonize the reduction of iron ore. There's also electrification of heating, which if you're in a country like Sweden or Norway or whatever, you've obviously got clean electricity to do that with. I think where steel becomes interesting is also the downstream side of it. So, for example, there was a, tying it in with electrification, there was a announcement that got quite a lot of coverage last week by Scania, the truck manufacturer, who basically said, look, we're going down electric battery trucks because we think that they just make more sense than hydrogen trucks. And a lot of people said, oh, well, that means nothing, no hydrogen involvement there then. But actually, if you read further down in the press release, one of the things that they were talking about was there's the truck usage itself, but then to decarbonize the actual truck, they were talking about using clean steel, and they saw hydrogen very much having a role in the production of steel that goes into the truck. They also they were also looking at hydrogen as a energy store that could back up some of the electric charging points if they're in things like remote locations where it would be cheaper, despite all the inefficiencies that people have gone about, it would be cheaper to do that than to put in a massive great for trucks, potentially megawatt scale grid connection in some remote area. And actually, I mean, in the same week, there was, have you come across the Extreme E thing? There's all these kind of celebs and motoring Damon Hills and
it sounds very interesting, whatever Extreme E is. It's certainly
sort of
something
driving
to attract
these electric.
I didn't quite reach the part of the press release that you got.
They're basically talking about driving these, I think, kind of like electric buggies. They're trying, like a kind of Dakar rally, but electric vehicles in lots of remote regions of the world. And there's a UK company whose name has just popped out of my head. Apologies to them. They make hydrogen fuel cells, and they're providing hydrogen fuel cells to provide charging points to these vehicles because they're going into the middle of this Saudi Arabian desert, so you can't set up a charge point. But what you can do is you can bring in a big fuel cell and use hydrogen to produce electricity the fuel cell and actually charge the vehicle in a remote location. So again, there's some interesting, I think where it becomes some of the hard to decarbonize stuff, I think, is also most lends itself to some of these crossovers. We've talked quite a lot about sector coupling, for example. I think it's the hard to decarbonize stuff is where you get synergies between crossovers, and which are not always entirely, you can't just argue entirely based on kind of simple kind of efficiency measures and that kind of stuff. It's some of the things are just difficult to do, and you have to do them inefficiently or not do them at all.
I think you've really hit upon something really interesting. We talked about hybrid schemes and a little bit about innovation. I wonder whether this might merit a separate podcast. I came across a splendidly named thing called a Batalyzer, which I put out on social media.
And
this Batalyzer It's something that I did a piece of work for an offshore wind company, and they were looking at offshore wind and hydrogen, as they all are. And I thought, well, it's only a matter of time before people realise that electrolyzers don't like being switched on and off. You're going to need some kind of backup, not something that's just designed for 2 hours to keep the aviation lights on, something perhaps a long-term store. And I was thinking in fuel cell terms, and then along comes this battleizer. Now, the battleizer is not out there yet. It's still in concept stage, but it's an example, I think, of the joined-up thinking. And I think it's. I think we did, didn't we? Did one on transport itself, a session in which we said, look, don't think of it in terms of either or. There are synergies, and it seems that Scania, from what you're saying, are starting to tease in to the wider end-to-end product life, if you like, almost in circular terms, and say there's a place for everything. Coming back to some of the other things that you flagged right at the start, I think you mentioned, was it cement? Was it? Did you say? I have seen some movement on the porcelain. I don't know how that ties into the wider cement picture. But...
That was a slight aside, and probably shows boredom of lockdown. But I was watching the Great Pottery Throwdown. It's like UK program where they get. They get people to kind of make pots, and obviously lots of chaos ensues, and their pots collapse and break and all this kind of stuff, and they get judged and thrown off the program. anyway, the kind of relevant bit to that was, as I was watching it, because they were all using these kilns, heating up to enormously high temperature and using gas burners, and the thing that occurred to me, being sad energy type, was blimey, what's the carbon footprint of pot making? And so and then as you mentioned, and I saw the same story the other day, this thing about ceramics and decarbonizing ceramics. So yeah, somebody's already
what it does tell me is that these hard to reach sectors, now correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't some of these exempt from the original kind of carbon levies that were proposed around about 2020?
Not an expert on the whole European carbon market thing, but there was lots of controversy because some of the big industries, steel was one of them, were given big dollops of carbon credits, basically, at the start of that scheme, to ostensibly to kind of compensate them, I think, for the fact that it was obviously kind of impossible or too difficult to kind of instantly go from being a huge emitter to a tiny emitter. But the unwanted benefit for the steel companies of that was they kind of held on to them, and then several years later they had billions of euros worth of carbon credits that they could sell. So it kind of highlighted one of the difficulties in making some of these schemes work. But when you start looking around things like, say, ceramics, pottery, steel, cement, there's lots and lots of very energy intensive industries, and you're either, there's a certain amount you can do with efficiency, but fundamentally for cement, for example, if you've got to bake limestone at 1500 degrees centigrade or whatever it is to break it down into the components that you want, there's not a lot you can do without. You can either use less cement, which is a perfectly valid thing to do, but there's not really a way to make that process more efficient. You've fundamentally got to provide a whacking dollop of heat to do it, and you either do it with coal or coke, which they do currently, or you replace that with electric heating or hydrogen or whatever else or biomass or whatever other kind of thing you want to dream up instead.
Yeah, there's that hot potato scheme, isn't there, up in Cumbria at the moment, that consented coal mine. Was that for a mining thing, which again is another perhaps hard to reach view in the extraction. Initiatives in Australia to look
at
even
an interesting
that.
One, yeah.
So
yeah, that's, it's a kind of interesting one, because that the controversy obviously is that the UK is hosting COP26 or whatever number it is later on this year, and it's obviously got all these climate targets and so on, and then they've consented to build a new coal mine in Cumbria. Now the coal mine in Cumbria, my understanding is the specifics of it is it's providing coking coal for steel. And the argument in favour of it is that the production here, that coking coal here, will have a lower footprint than using coking coal that's been imported over from China or whatever. And so if it's used for steel here, it will actually be lower carbon than it could have been. But obviously,
it's a minuscule
benefit compared to transitioning your steel over to not using coking coal at all. So it's, but yeah, it's a.
If you're a politician, wouldn't you come up with something? All right, we'll make 20% of it green, and we'll test some of these new things that you and I talk about, and ship some of this kit in, and make part of it a test area, and then everybody's happy. You've got your existing consent, and you've got something that appeases those that are less charitably disposed towards such. It's only 100 miles or so, isn't it, from Glasgow to Cumbria? So it does seem an astonishing political decision to have that in its drive of the conference.
It's classic non-joined-up thinking, but I think it's also tied very much into what we've talked about a lot, which is jobs. They kind of, the trade-off was, it's going to create however many hundred jobs. And certainly the local council was very much kind of, okay, I don't care what about any of the carbon footprint, we want the jobs.
And the government historically. I mean, jobs, you would have thought, well, they're probably jobs in the slaving industry or the tobacco. All these people had big supply chains, they all had employment, and yet they're not there anymore. So, yeah, that's an important local decision. But if you're hosting a global organisation, a landmark kind of thing, 100 miles up the road, it does send a bit of a strange signal out.
I mean, it seems a massively short-sighted and short-term thing to do. But again, I'm just sort of pointing out some of the rationale, I think, that was used. And it's a good example of where the government can say one thing and have certain set of priorities on one side in theory, but then when you come down to practice, it's not always quite the same. Many examples of that.
Yeah, I think that's that euphemism, commitment, isn't it? And then when it's hard and when it's controversial, and then it's always like that, I suppose, with any major infrastructure projects. We've mentioned in part of transport is shipping, which there are initiatives in there. We've mentioned bunker fuel, haven't we, in passing, and some of the things. I think there are initiatives underway for that form of transport. We've mentioned cement. Is there any other big industry? What about agriculture, which again we were confidently predicting? We had the unions, and every farm was going to be generated within 10 years, and it all went a bit pear-shaped. I think the planning laws didn't help that, but you know, agriculture is a big user, and perhaps chemicals as well, some of those industries. But well, come on, guys, you know, the clock is ticking. Glasgow 2030, it's 9 years away, a little bit longer for England, but in major project terms, it's not that kind of 7 seconds to midnight type of clock that they used to put up, but it's certainly the clock is there.
Well, I mean, chemicals, obviously, it's largely hydrocarbons is primary feedstock for most of that, so that's obviously prime sector. There's things that tie together, so a lot of that gets kept. The agricultural sector is a big user. There's lots of, again, I've not looked at it in closely, but my understanding, talking to other people, is there's an awful lot of tech in agriculture which is potentially transformative in terms of how much chemicals and also things like water is used. People, when they think about tech in agriculture, often think about GM crops and all that kind of stuff, and that's one side of it. But the other side is just IT and monitoring systems and so on, where they can now, for example, just apply water to specific points in the field. They don't just have to go across and spray the whole thing. And the same with pesticides and so on. It's much more, they have kind of cameras, automated cameras going across and identifying individually which plants need something, and they just apply it there. And so there are some quite transformative things. So we can look at demand, we can look at efficiency, and that'll be driven by efficiency. It'll be cheaper for the farmer not to buy, I don't know, a million gallons of pesticide if they only have to buy 100,000 gallons of pesticide. So there's some things like that I think we can look at. Fundamentally then with that, it's kind of going back to the source and decarbonising the source. So it's either carbon capture and storage, potentially on some of these industrial sites, could be cheaper in the end than changing the fuel sources or changing the using green hydrogen, for example. It might just be cheaper to capture the emissions and then use the emissions to do something like produce methanol, I don't know. So there's various kind of routes that you can follow, and I think that's where it becomes complicated, because whenever there's obviously lots of routes, there's also lots of different sectors which have, some will win, some will lose, there's lots of lobbying, they're all in the policymakers' ears saying different things, and yeah, it's so, quite, I mean, it's, I think that's UK, also why it can be quite slow to get things done.
If you were UK PLC, wouldn't it be wise to hedge and say, well, we know these industrial clusters, we've talked about them in the past, there's about 8 or something, why not one green and one blue and perhaps one some other shade on that, and then have just a hedge and see, as they did with renewables. It was wind has won through, I think, now, but in the early days we didn't know biomass might have made a big surge, and when this wind falls down, when the earth tremor, who knows what so the grid's going to fall over, which one through. So why not have a hedge on some of these strategies on a national and perhaps even wider, and some will focus on certain elements, others will focus on that, perhaps a few interconnectors to make it all work up, and everybody working together in a wider joined up hybrid type of picture, with the hydro power being shipped in by an interconnector from Scotland or Norway, and then see things in the round, or are they already thinking about that? Is that what's already happened?
Yeah, I think, I mean, to be fair, on one hand you could say, I mean, everyone in any sector always thinks the government isn't doing enough for their sector. That's just a law of business. On the other hand, I don't think it's for governments to, as you say, I don't think they should be saying, right, we should all go down the route of battery and not do any hydrogen, or equally we should go down the route of hydrogen, not do any XYZ. But I think it's kind of where the line is, investing some public money into trials, pilot projects, that kind of stuff, R&D, I think is absolutely fine. And they're doing that, to be fair. At least looking at the UK, they've got investments across all sorts of different things, from hydrogen heating trials to EV charging stuff to putting money behind kind of setting up battery plants and all that kind of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of different investments. And then I think ultimately after that, I think it'd be less the case of different sectors coming together. I think they'll come together when it suits them. I think then it's competition. It will be ultimately okay. We've given you a bit of a head start, as we did with renewables, with wind, with solar. I mean, still investing test sites in things like tidal, which you could say, a lot of people would say, well, it's been around for years, it's not really gone anywhere, is it ever going to go anywhere, why don't we pull that money out and put it into something else? Fusion would be the classic one. How many billions have been spent on that without and yet we're still maybe years away. But I'm certainly not of the mind that we shouldn't be investing in those things. I think the more options we have and investigating kind of what the pros and cons of those options are at an early stage, and identifying kind of what the potential is for them, is kind of a government role. And then after that, then they can compete. They can compete with each other, and there'll be sectors where also they choose to hybridise, and it makes sense for each side on a specific application to come up with a hybrid solution. So I think, I mean, broadly speaking, I think that's a good approach. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of lobbying, a lot of arguments, and a lot of every side obviously thinks that the other one is a waste of money, of public money, and that all the public money should come to them. And I just don't think we'll ever get away from that kind of scenario.
Okay, we've talked a lot about the hard-to-reach sectors. I don't know if there's any that we haven't discovered or winkled out. There was one alcoholic beverage that seemed to be well-suited to reaching the parts. I don't know whether they've gone down, I think they probably have gone down the sustainability route.
Yeah, I've had people from Heineken on courses before. Trying to think which ones. I think there's been a variety, actually. They're clearly doing something, things with biomass, because they have waste, they have leftovers, so things like biogas and so on. I'm sure there was one where they were looking at some geothermal heating as well. So, yeah, all those kind of sectors, individual companies will always kind of be doing their own things, I think. For their bottom line, for their shareholders, for their kind of social responsibility and so on. But I think it's how do you speed that up? I suppose the question we're getting at is, none of the stuff we've talked about is impossible to decarbonize, but it's hard to decarbonize. The other way maybe of looking at that is slow to decarbonise. You could, if it's a case of speed, I guess what we're maybe looking at now from a policy point of view is, okay, the easy stuff, we don't really need to subsidise wind and solar and other things, at least in terms of direct subsidies, because they're competitive. We might, there might be some planning supports and so on which are useful, but do we now shift focus into the stuff that seems to have been taking ages to get started? So maybe it's a timescale issue as much as a difficulty issue.
So are you predicting some kind of shuffling around of the CFD pot? Is that being lobbied? I'm sure it's been lobbied for, but then perhaps I know there are various categories of pots, weren't there, with some on the new and not mature, and then the others in the mature with different rates. And perhaps, I don't know what the rate of review of those, but if that's one of your major tools, then perhaps that's ripe for a review and see what.
Well, they are. I think they're consulting on it at the moment, aren't they? Aren't they mid-consultation? I can't remember what the time frame for that is. But yeah, I almost certainly we'll see a shift from the electricity point of view in terms of pots and what competes with what. I'd be interested to see where, I mean, arguably offshore wind is almost getting to the stage where it can compete with onshore and yeah, solar and so on. But then you might have things like floating offshore wind might have its own identity, that kind of stuff. So I think what becomes interesting is whether you apply the same kind of principles with the CFD thing into other segments like green gases, or whether you or how you tweak some of the carbon trading and carbon market stuff as well. People have talked about having basically a CFD process where the strike price is a carbon price rather than the strike price being an electricity price. And those kind of things would be much more applicable within kind of industrial scenarios. And again, you can combine that with a mandate and say that industry has to use 20%, 30% of clean whatever. So there's various mechanisms. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see what policymakers come up with, really.
Okay, I think we've covered most of the main targets in the hard to reach sector. Is there any other that we've not discussed that we would be crying out for some kind of assessment and review, and how do we get to where we need to be from this situation we are in?
I'm sure there's loads. There's probably a separate we'd probably have a separate discussion one time about aviation, for example. Issue in itself out. So I think as we've talked, maybe what's come out is that there's maybe hard to decarbonize is we'd sort of start need to define what we mean by hard. So you could think hard as in technically hard. I think a lot of these things maybe aren't technically hard to decarbonize. The reason we call them hard to decarbonize is because they've been slow to decarbonize, because there's not been much incentive for them to do so, or it's been expensive for them to do so. Maybe it was just as expensive for electricity to decarbonize, but we just put more focus onto that. Maybe it's just a shift of focus, which will make what we've traditionally thought of hard to decarbonize industries suddenly move much quicker. So I think there's an element, maybe of kind of timescale and focus to it as much as anything.
Yeah.
And as I say, I think the other one is, I think the background to certainly things like heating is efficiency, how to properly incentivize, monetize and drive better efficiency, and I think that has to come from a government level in particular.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else? I think a very thorough discussion on some of the hard to reach elements today. Is there anything else that we should be adding in at this stage?
Well, as I say, there's always something we can add.
Another podcast, another day. But I suppose really we're guided by our listeners at this stage. If there's anything we didn't really touch upon aviation, which does merit to perhaps another discussion in its own rights, especially. But there are even initiatives there that early stage. It's not going to be overnight. Certainly not going to meet Glasgow's 2030. So if you're a city that's subscribed to this and you've got an airport in a curtilage, Manchester springs to mind. I think the council owns a good portion of the airport, and you've signed up to it. You really, really should be starting to address some of the issues around that. But that's a separate, perhaps, discussion at another time.
Yeah, I think we've covered plenty of ground. We've raised plenty of issues, maybe it's just the last decade was very much around electricity. Maybe the the next one that's just going to be a bit of a shift of focus towards areas that haven't really been sort of driven to decarbonize as much as they could have done. So yeah, let's see how it goes.
I suppose we thank our listeners at this stage for for all the comments that you've made about our 40 existing podcasts. If you'd like to come to John and I with some ideas as to what you'd like us to discuss on the energy transition, hopefully you found today's discussion of interest, and we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll speak to you on the next one, whatever subject that may be. Okay, bye for now.
Bye.